Hello there, and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 23. This one is called King Solomon. King Solomon. Before we get started, I want to give a bit of a disclaimer. I wrote this sermon last week, and I presented it on Saturday, just hours before the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history ever happened in Orlando. Now, this was an awful, horrendous, evil event that is hard for us to wrap our minds around. Some of the themes that happened in Orlando are consistent with what I talk about here in this sermon. And I have to tell you that because it may not feel like I'm addressing fully what happened in Orlando, and I'm telling you that I'm not because I wrote this before it. So I tell you all that to let you know that I will be writing something about Orlando here, either this week's sermon with King Rehoboam, and if it doesn't address it, then I will be doing another sermon because I feel like this is something that needs to be addressed because it is an unspeakable evil. So I wanted to be very upfront with you and tell you that, yes, I'm not going to address Orlando at this time, even though a lot of the themes are consistent with the way I will address Orlando here in the future. So I just wanted to let you know that before we begin. But now that that's been addressed, I'd like to invite you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 6, 11 to 22, where we hear about David's son who overtakes the kingdom, and we hear about what he does with his life. So 1 Kings 6, 11 to 22 reads this. Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon. Concerning this house that you are building, if you will walk in my statutes, obey my ordinances, and keep all my commandments by walking in them, then I will establish my promise with you, which I made to your father David. I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. So Solomon built the house and finished it. He lined the walls of the house on the inside with boards of cedar. From the floor of the house to the rafters of the ceiling, he covered them on the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the house with boards of cypress. He built 20 cubits of the rear of the house with boards of cedar from the floors to the rafters, and he built this within an inner sanctuary as the most holy place. Now, just a side note here, you should know that cedar had to be imported, and it was one of the most expensive materials of Solomon's time. So when Solomon is building this temple on the inside with cedar, he is basically sparing no expense for this massive, opulent temple. Back to verse 17, it says, "The house, that is, the nave in front of the inner sanctuary, was 40 cubits long. The cedar within the house had carvings of gourds and open flowers. All was cedar. No stone was seen. The inner sanctuary he prepared in the innermost part of the house to set there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. The interior of the inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid the altar with cedar. Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold. Then he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. Next, Solomon overlaid the whole house with gold in order that the whole house might be perfect. Even the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary, he overlaid with gold. Solomon built his temple to God, sparing no expense. The temple, according to scripture, was the most magnificent structure in all of Israelite history. Now, unfortunately, in the 6th century BCE, it was leveled by the Babylonians when they conquered Israel. And it was rebuilt later, just a few hundred years later, by Herod the Great. And then it was leveled in 70 CE by the Roman army. And the temple is no more. But it is still legendary within Christian and Jewish circles because this is a temple filled with magnificence, opulence, and decadence. It was so legendary, in fact, that in the 6th century CE, a man named Justinian decided to compete with Solomon. He built the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, Turkey, which you can go and visit this day. Now, if you were to go and visit the Hagia Sophia, you would walk in, and as your eyes drift upwards, you would see a dome that is massive and would make your jaw drop. It is an awe-inspiring structure. And this building was built with one purpose. The legend goes that the builder, Justinian, walked into the Hagia Sophia upon its completion, looked up at the dome, and looked at his scribes then and said, "Solomon, I have vanquished thee." In other words, Solomon set the bar this high with his temple in Jerusalem, and Justinian believed that he had surpassed Solomon in his greatness and created the greatest piece of human architecture ever. And as we read through 1 Kings and we hear about this temple that was legendary not only in Solomon's time, but in Justinian's time, and now in our time today, the discerning mind would look at this magnificence and splendor and wealth and riches and ask a very simple question. Where did this temple come from? How was it built? Because for us to build a temple similar to Solomon's day would require a massive amount of resources that is frightening to think about. Where did this temple come from, and how did Solomon come to power to the point where he could build a temple lined with gold? Well, in order to answer that question, we have to look at the history of Israel. Israel's history begins in Genesis chapter 12 with a man named Abraham. God, in the midst of the desert, says to Abraham, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Now, it's important for you to notice here what God is calling Abraham to be, a tribe that blesses others. This is significant because in Abraham's day and age, tribes didn't bless one another. Tribes stole from each other. Tribes killed each other. Tribes fought with one another. And so Abraham is asked by God to start a new kind of tribe, not a tribe that takes and takes and takes, but instead a tribe that gives, that is generous, a tribe that blesses others. That is what Israel is all about. And so Abraham lives with this calling and this idea. I'm going to create a tribe that won't kill other tribes, but instead will bless other tribes. And so Abraham does the best he can to guide his family to be that kind of tribe. And so Abraham passes that legacy on to his son Isaac, who passes that legacy on to his son Jacob, who passes that legacy on to his son Joseph. Now, Joseph and his brothers did not get along. I know it's very different than today, where all brothers get along perfectly and everything's great. But Joseph's brothers did not get along with Joseph, and they tricked him, they trapped him, and they sold him into slavery in Egypt. Yeah, crazy. Brothers selling other brothers into slavery. And so Joseph goes to Egypt. He eventually rises to power. He helps guide Egypt through a terrible drought. It benefits not only Egypt, but the people of Israel as well. And the people of Israel settle in Egypt in the midst of a drought. Joseph is a celebrated hero of Egypt. But shortly after his death, we read in Exodus chapter 1, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor." And the people of Israel, this tribe that is supposed to bless other tribes, ends up in slavery for 400 years. There are 10 generations of Israelite people who know nothing but slavery. These people, the Israelites, are so oppressed in their slavery that they cry out to God for help. And God responds by talking to his servant Moses. We read in Exodus chapter 3, God saying to Moses, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of the taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians." You see, God is in the liberation business, and God fights for those who are oppressed. Well, as we continue to read through Exodus, we read how God, through a mighty hand, brings his people out of slavery, leads them across the Red Sea to a place called Mount Sinai. And it is here at Mount Sinai when these freed slaves are breathing fresh, free air for the very first time in 10 generations that God appears on Mount Sinai and gives Moses the Ten Commandments. These Ten Commandments are to be the cornerstone of their new tribe. This tribe that is at its core supposed to bless others. And we read the very first commandment in Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 to 2. God said this to Moses, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." You see, something we can learn about God is that a tribe that blesses other tribes is a tribe that is out of the house of slavery. Slavery has no part in God's tribe because slavery is against God's way. And so when we hear about that first commandment, the very essence and core of that commandment is this: you are to be a different tribe out of the house of slavery. So the people of Israel, with their commandments in hand, head out across the desert. They wander around for several more years until, toward the end of his life, Moses climbs up Mount Nebo, just short of the promised land, and passes away. After Moses' death, a man named Joshua takes charge. He leads God's people into the land of Israel and conquers Israel, and the people of Israel settle in the land that God gave them. 400 years later, the people of Israel ask God for a king, and God gives them a king, a man named Saul. Now, Saul makes some choices that lead people who write the Bible to say he was a bad king, and they take away the throne and they take away the crown of Saul and give it to his rival, a man named David. David assumes the crown, and he is a great military conqueror. He expands Israel's borders. He settles the nation, and all of a sudden, there's this expansive, rich nation that David hands over on his deathbed to his son, Solomon. And so Solomon, for the first time in Israel's history, is not just taking over a nomadic tribe, but instead is taking over a throne, is taking over a nation that is well established. And the question became for Solomon, now that you're king, Solomon, what will you do with your power? Now that you're king, Solomon, what kind of nation will you become? Now that you're king, Solomon, what will you build? And so Solomon built the temple. Now this is a temple erected in honor of a God who builds nations out of the house of slavery. But where did this temple come from? How did Solomon build it? And in 1 Kings 5:13, we read how Solomon built it. We read, King Solomon conscripted forced labor out of all Israel. The levy numbered 30,000 men. And here's Solomon building a temple to the God who frees slaves by enslaving other human beings. Here's Solomon, who is placing the Ten Commandments in the most holy place. And on those Ten Commandments, commandment number one is a commandment to be a nation out of the house of slavery. And yet it is enclosed in a building built on the backs of slaves. And you may say to yourself, well, how is it that Solomon didn't see this conundrum? How did he not see that this was a problem? Well, in 1 Kings chapter 9, we read how this wasn't a problem for Solomon. We read all the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the people of Israel. Their descendants who were still in the land, whom the Israelites were unable to destroy completely, these Solomon conscripted for slave labor. And so they are to this day. But of the Israelites, Solomon made no slaves. And so Solomon and all of Israel at this time is basically living by a mantra. Slavery is wrong if it's the Israelites who are slaves. In other words, what they're basically saying by this giant, opulent building to the God who frees slaves is this. They are saying slavery's okay as long as we aren't the slaves. And so when Solomon and his advisors and his theologians read that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, they said, oh, that just means as long as we aren't the slaves. But when you look at what Israel had become, in all of its richness and grandness and glory, we realize that the kingdom of Israel looked a lot like Egypt. And the kingdom of Israel, at its heart, just like Egypt, had a real slavery problem. But the problems of Israel didn't end with slaves. In 1 Kings chapter 9, we read about another problem with this brand new, shiny, gleamy kingdom. 1 Kings 9 reads this. This is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon conscripted to build the house of the Lord and his own house, the Millo and the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Solomon is building Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, which are military bases. He is enslaving people in order to protect all of his massive wealth and resources throughout the land. And so Solomon, the reason he has slaves is because he wants to have all sorts of military bases to protect all that he has accumulated. And we read in 1 Kings chapter 10, the very next chapter, that Solomon wanted to protect all of his richness and wealth. And so we read that Solomon gathered together chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses. Now, this is fascinating because in the very same book, not the same book of the Bible, but the same Bible, we have a book called the Psalms. And if you were to read Psalm chapter 20, you would read a verse that reads this: "Some trust in chariots and others in horses, but we depend on the Lord our God." Let me ask you something about Solomon. Who does Solomon trust more in? His chariots and his horses, or in God? Does Solomon trust more in God or in the military bases that he has to use slaves to build? Where does Solomon's trust lie? When we read about Solomon accumulating all sorts of weapons and military bases, we realize that it is all driven by the same thing: fear. Fear. In other words, we have something valuable in our country. We don't want other people to get it, so we're going to stockpile weapons until we know that we are safe. This looks a lot like Egypt. And it is here that we realize that the kingdom of Israel, just like Egypt, had a very real fear problem. But the problems don't end there. In 1 Kings chapter 10, we read about something else that Solomon did. We read, "A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150. So through the king's traders, they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Aram." And as we read what Solomon is doing here, we realize that he is accumulating wealth by buying and selling weapons of war. In other words, Solomon has become an arms dealer. Solomon realizes that war is profitable, and he can profit off war and make his kingdom more rich by buying and selling weapons. And when we look at what this tribe was called to be in Genesis chapter 12, "So that you will be a blessing, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed," is that what an arms dealer is? Because what should be abundantly clear to all of us as we read through scripture is this: Solomon has lost his way, and he is no longer blessing other tribes. He is instead becoming rich off of other tribes. But we are not the only ones who realize that Solomon has lost his way. The narrator in 1 Kings chapter 10 says the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. That number, 666, has been a long-standing number of opposition to God. It is almost like the narrator is grabbing us by our collar and saying, "Solomon has sold his soul to the devil for more money. We lost our way." And we realize that the kingdom of Israel was very similar to Egypt in a very striking way. The kingdom of Israel, just like Egypt, had a weapons problem. So when we read through 1 Kings, we realize that Israel had a slavery problem. We realize that Israel had a fear problem. We realize that Israel had a weapons problem. In other words, Israel is just another Egypt. God asked the children of Israel to be a different kind of tribe. But what is so tragic about this story is that Israel went right back to being an oppressive, rich, powerful empire that ruled and rivaled other nations. Israel is just another Egypt. Also in 1 Kings, there is a very famous story about a queen from Sheba who comes and visits Solomon in the height of Solomon's wealth and power. And what I've been told so often throughout my life, growing up in church school, is that this visit validates the nation of Israel as a real power to be reckoned with. But when you read through the queen's story, you realize that she is not validating Solomon's position. Instead, she offers a major challenge. In 1 Kings 10:9, she looks at all of the wealth and all of the power and hears the wisdom of Solomon and then says these words to the king: "God has made you king to execute justice and righteousness." Justice and righteousness. With her words in mind, I have to ask you something. What drove Israel? Was it profit, power, and possessions? or was it justice and righteousness? What was more important when they were deciding to build the temple? Was it more important for profit, power, and possessions to rule the day? Or was it justice and righteousness? Because if it was justice and righteousness, do you really believe that this kingdom would have enslaved other human beings to build a temple to the God who frees slaves? What drove Israel? When it came to its weapons problem, was it profit, power, and possessions, or justice and righteousness? Because do you really need more weapons than everybody else if you are concerned with helping the widow, with helping the orphan? What drove Israel when it came to its fear problem? Were they really concerned with justice and righteousness, or were they concerned with protecting their profit, power, and possessions? You see, what I believe the Queen of Sheba is saying, oh, you've missed the point. You are here to execute justice and righteousness, and yet you have been obsessed with profit, power, and possessions. The Queen of Sheba is the hero of this story. So then, what does this have to do with us today? Well, the question I would like to ask you as you listen to this podcast is this. What drives America? What drives the United States of America? Is it profit, power, and possessions? Or is it justice and righteousness? Let's look at this country of ours and see if we can determine what drives our country. In 2014, the United States was approximately 4% of the world's population. In that same year, the United States controlled over 50% of the global weaponry market. In other words, we have gotten very good at being an arms dealer, much like Solomon. We buy and sell more weapons than everybody else. How much? Well, there are over 190 countries, and we control over 50% of the global weaponry market. To give you an idea of how much we sell, in 2013, we sold $26 billion worth of weapons to the world. 1 year later, we sold $36 billion worth of weapons to the world. The second place country in global arms dealing in 2014 was Russia, who sold $10 billion in weapon total. That is how much we increased in 1 year. Not only that, but it is not a global weapons arm dealing problem that we have. Because in 2013, there were roughly 317 million people living in the United States. In that same year, we had 357 million personal firearms owned in the United States. There were 40 million more guns than people in this country. When we look at Israel, we realize that it was similar to Egypt in the fact that it had a major weapons problem. I believe that the United States of America has a weapons problem today. And the question behind this weapons problem is this: what drives America? Is it profit, power, and possessions? Or is it justice and righteousness? Because profit, power, and possessions are important things, but are they the most important thing? Or do they lose out to justice and righteousness? And if they did, what would that look like? I don't think it would look like the weapons that we own today. When it comes to our decisions as a country and what to do with our weapons, may we change our thinking so that justice and righteousness drive the decisions we make with those weapons. What drives America? Profit, power, and possessions, or justice and righteousness? Last year, our annual budget for the military was $601 billion. That's about $19,000 a second that we spent on our military. Not only that, but every 2.5 seconds, our military spends more money than the average American income. We spend a lot of money on our military. It's so ridiculous, in fact, that a man named Sebastian Younger, a war journalist, wrote a book called War in 2015. And in that book, he was talking about a new weapon called the Javelin. The Javelin is the modern-day bazooka, and it requires two soldiers to fire one round. And in his book, War, Sebastian Younger writes these words: each javelin round costs $80,000. And the idea that it is fired by a guy who doesn't make that in a year at a guy who doesn't make that in a lifetime is somehow so outrageous, it almost makes the war seem winnable. We are firing weapons that cost $80,000 a shot. and we are valuing those weapons over the people who fire them. We have got a problem here. Why is it that we allow this to happen? I believe because it's similar to Israel, and that is similar to Egypt, in the fact that they both had a fear problem. We are afraid that we are going to lose these massive amounts of wealth and resources. And I would say that the only reason we can justify spending this much money on our military and weapons is very simple, because the United States of America has a fear problem. And when we hear the psalmist say that some trust in chariots, some trust in horses, but we trust in God, I believe that we're the ones with the chariots. We're the ones with the horses. We're the ones with the weapons, and we trust more in our weapons than we do in God. Why? Because we are afraid. We, the United States of America, have a very real fear problem. What drives America? Is it profit, power, and possessions, or justice and righteousness? Earlier in this teaching, we read the first commandment. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And when we look at the United States of America and its history, we all know it is riddled with the worst of the worst of slavery. And when we look at Israel and we look at Egypt, we say they had a slavery problem. And we look at our history, we like to rush to this idea that we too had a slavery problem. But is it really over? Are we done with slavery? Are we actually a nation who is out of the house of slavery, or do we struggle with slavery today? Is slavery a thing of the past, or is it part of our economy today? And in order to answer that question, I'd like to ask you more questions. Where did your clothes come from? The clothes that you are wearing now, who made them? Because we have shifted the way that we have done clothes in a radical fashion in just the past few years. In the 1960s, 95% of Americans' clothes were made in America. In 1990, half of Americans' clothes were made in America. And in 2015, 2% of Americans' clothes were made in America. 98% of the people who make American clothing aren't Americans, and we keep outsourcing our textile industry further and further away from us. Why? Because labor is cheaper the farther away it is from us. Now, to give you an idea of why we keep outsourcing this clothing, it's because we like to buy clothes. According to the Los Angeles Times, the average American purchases 63 garments and 8 pairs of shoes each year. But we don't keep clothes for very long, because the average American throws away 82 pounds of clothing each year. We are throwing clothes away at an alarming rate. Why do we go through this cycle of buying so many clothes and then turning around and throwing those clothes away? Well, it's because clothing's cheap now. We can hire people across the Pacific Ocean for less than $3 a day to make our clothing. And these people are found in Vietnam, they're found in Bangladesh, they're found all over Southeast Asia, and they make our clothes in droves over there for a ridiculously small amount. Not only that, but their working conditions are abhorrent. To give you an idea of how bad it was, on April 23, 2013, a television crew visited a place called the Rana Plaza. Now, the Rana Plaza was a 6-story building, and on the top 4 floors of that building, it was occupied by factories that made Westerners clothes. Now, this television crew was looking around the Rana Plaza because they were trying to ask the question, where do our clothes come from? And as they were looking around this building and seeing their clothes being made, the television crew pointed out several cracks in the structural columns of the Rana Plaza. It was so alarming, in fact, that they evacuated the whole building on April 23. And people said, you know, I don't want to go back in there. We don't want to work. But after the owners came down and looked at the Rana Plaza, they said, it's fine, get back to work or you're fired. And so all of these textile workers went back into the plaza, went back into the building the very next day on April 24. And at 9 a.m., the Rana Plaza collapsed, killing 1,100 textile workers. It was awful. The Rana Plaza was the second deadliest building collapse in human history, second only to the World Trade Center, which was viciously attacked by outsiders. When the building collapsed, it ran on several news networks because this is where our clothes came from. One American viewer, a man named Andrew Morgan, saw this collapse and decided to do something about it. He wanted to make a movie asking the question, where do our clothes come from? And this movie just was released. It's now on Netflix. It's called The True Cost, and it's very well done. But in perhaps one of the most moving moments of the movie, Andrew Morgan interviews a woman named Shima Akhtar. Shima lives in Bangladesh. She worked not too far from the Rana Plaza. And as he asked her about this collapse, Shima began to tear up, thinking about how that should have been her, how that could have been her in that building because she works in the same terrible conditions for less than $3 a day. And through tears, she says to Andrew Morgan, "These clothes that you wear are made with our blood." And look, I'm pro clothes, obviously. I think you should all wear clothes. But I think the question we need to ask anytime we step into a store is very simple. Where do these clothes come from? You see, Israel was a shining, beautiful, gleaming empire, but at its core, it had a slavery problem. I believe that the United States of America has a slavery problem. We enslave others for cheaper clothes. And as we look at the United States of America and we look at Israel and we look at Egypt, the question is, are we just building another Egypt? Because we have a weapons problem. We have a fear problem. We have a slavery problem. And you may say to me, "Craig, I don't understand. Are you saying we shouldn't have a military?" Of course I'm not. My question is, what drives the military? Is it profit, power, and possessions? Or is it justice and righteousness? When it comes to the clothes that we wear, what drives the purchases that you make? Is it profit, power, and possessions? Or is it justice and righteousness? Because as much as we want to look at the country and say, well, the country is more about this or more about that, the question that ultimately the text is asking you today in 2016 is this: what drives you? Are you driven by profit, power, and possessions? Or are you driven by justice and righteousness? Because the story of King Solomon is simple. Profit, power, and possessions are terrible things when they are the primary objective for your life. But when God calls you to be one of God's followers, justice and righteousness should be the most important thing. Profit, power, and possessions all have a place in God's kingdom as long as they are subservient to justice and righteousness. The question I have for you as you consider the story of Solomon is simple. What drives you? Profit, power, and possessions, or justice and righteousness? May we all become people of justice and righteousness.